And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Pillar, who has served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously, he served as Chief of the Analytic Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He also headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence's Counterterrorism Center from 1997 to 1999, and was Director of the Center. Paul Pillar is currently a Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He, along with a group of senior military officers, recently signed a full-page letter to President Obama in the Washington Post, urging Mr. President, say no to a war of choice with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Pillar.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And what do you make of the filibuster of Rand Paul in, by Rand Paul against the all but certain nomination of John Brennan to head up the CIA, in the sense that he has obviously become perhaps a temporary hero on the political left, but at the same time, his message resonates with, I think, his more authentic base, which is on the libertarian right and to some extent amongst anti-government militia groups. So politically, what is going on here in terms of a broad spectrum of American people, even though I believe 83% of Americans support the use of drones against in terms of target assassination, yet there is obviously a real disquiet and an unusual alliance here on the left and the right.
Well, politically, there are several things going on. First of all, I would salute Senator Paul for actually doing a stand-up talking filibuster, which is something we haven't seen for some time. And a lot of people expressed disappointment when we had this so-called set of reforms to the filibuster a few weeks back that Harry Reid and company did not go as far as to go back to requiring senators to actually do what Rand Paul did. He's clearly making a splash in another respect. It's hard to imagine another young, pretty new senator getting all the publicity he has. But setting aside all those political aspects, I think there's still a couple of other levels here. You are quite correct that for most people, the drone program is not something that should be discarded. It is seen as a legitimate tool in the eyes of most Americans to go after terrorists. Nonetheless, especially, though not exclusively, because of the way U.S. citizens have been involved as targets, and this, of course, goes back specifically to the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, in which he, as well as one of his colleagues and his teenage son, were targets, or at least they were killed by drone strikes in Yemen. There have been issues that are of concern, and I think legitimate concern, on both the libertarian right, with which Rand Paul is associated, and what we could describe as the civil liberties left, as to this whole program as an instance of executive power perhaps going farther and going more unchecked than many Americans believe it ought to be. And that's the final sort of political dimension at which the Rand Paul filibuster was operating, I think, and he's made this clear himself. The immediate topic was the drone program, but he's speaking more broadly about the issue of executive power and just how checked or unchecked it ought to be.
Well, in terms of the Senate and the issue of filibuster, which you just raised, Paul Pillar, it's extraordinary to think that at the same time Rand Paul got all of this publicity for his stand-up filibuster, which harkens back to the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. At the same time, there was a silent filibuster of a judicial appointee to the very important circuit court in D.C., which has four vacancies, including the vacancy left by the now Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. And it's pretty clear that the Republicans are simply holding up appointees to this key court that makes incredibly important decisions, and also feeds a lot of justices to the Supreme Court itself.
That's right. And some editorial writers made exactly the connection you did, noting the contrast between the stand-up filibuster on the drone strikes and what we have come to see as routine, which is the silent filibuster, if you can call it that, which is basically if the minority says nothing's going to go unless you have 60 votes, it's not going to go. We're talking about the D.C. Court of Appeals here, which, as you noted, is generally considered as the most important circuit court, not only because it's a sort of feeding ground to the Supreme Court, but in its own right, it handles the lion's share, the great majority of cases involving federal departments, simply because it is here in D.C. And on these sets of issues that we began talking about, things like the counterterrorist powers and how they may affect and raise issues of due process and so on, it has been the key court by far at the appellate level. And what we have right now politically is a situation in which there, because of the vacancies on that court, conservatives see themselves as having a majority with the sitting justices, and so they see it in their interest just to keep the vacancies from being filled. The latest talk I've heard about the possible Democratic response to this is for the president possibly to come up with multiple nominees to fill vacancies and then challenge the Republicans to try to come up with legitimate-sounding reasons why all of the nominees supposedly are not qualified for the court.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Pillar, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He also was Deputy Chief of the Counterterrorism Center from 1997 to 1999 and is currently a Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. Let's turn to the more paramilitary CIA that John Brennan is inheriting. And obviously, his predecessor, ill-fated as his tenure was attracted, at least if you heard the tape that Bob Woodward managed to get hold of, that had an emissary of Fox News offering the presidency to General Petraeus, and he at one point in the tape he mentions that he's really interested not in being the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, which obviously wasn't being offered to him, but he was interested in heading up the CIA because he thought that was where all the action was going to be in the future. So, is it a new agency now? Is it not just about gathering intelligence and analyzing intelligence? Is it more of a paramilitary organization?
Well, first of all, I think we should give some credit to David Petraeus, who I think came across pretty well in that tape, in not jumping at Roger Ailes's offer of having Fox News be a basically a presidential campaign support team for him. His desire to head the CIA was legitimate for very legitimate professional reasons, and I take my hat off to him for that, regardless of everything else that has come up subsequently. But on the broader question that you ask, Ian, about the nature of this agency, the main thing I would emphasize to your listeners is, what we hear publicly and that gets all the public attention is not a fair or accurate representation of how the work and the priority and the resources and the personnel are distributed. We hear a great deal about something like the drone program because it is a point of understandable controversy. But in terms of people and dollars and priority, it's really a very small part of what takes place. The much larger part is the traditional intelligence functions of collecting and analyzing information on what's going on overseas. And for the great majority of officers who come to work each day, that's what they're doing, or supporting those functions, and their relationship to something like firing missiles from drones is basically reading about it in the newspapers, just like the rest of us.
Well, I'm sure you remember the long and repeated testimony from William Colby, which led to the church and park committees and led to the President Ford banning assassination. And of course, assassination is at the heart of the drone issue because it is an instrument of assassination, in as much as a sniper rifle is, I imagine, except that it's more high tech and it seems to elicit a very passionate emotional response from a lot of people, both on the libertarian right and on the left, in terms of it being raising some serious moral issues. But I have a broader question just about in general, and that is that throughout the history of the CIA, it's been the presidents who have used the CIA as almost the favorite toy of the executive branch, and going through Jack Kennedy and others, even though he vowed to smash it after the Bay of Pigs, he used it with a vengeance, and others have. And the strange thing is that the president is sort of immune from criticism about everything gets essentially blamed on the CIA. And I'm wondering about this current issue now of how much the White House has tried to keep the drone program as secret as possible. And now, as you know, the Rand Paul and others are sort of smoking them out and they're not really getting ahead of it. So are we back to that pattern where somehow the executive branch is immune from criticism when, in fact, it's the one that's pushing the envelope? Or is that, if that's indeed the case today?
Well, you're making a couple of very valid points here, Ian. One is there's a tendency by us, the public, to confuse institutional issues with policy issues. You referred back to William Colby in the 1970s, and in terms of law and procedure, we've come a long, long way since then. In fact, the key changes were made in the 1970s, and that's when we had established a legal framework for covert action, which requires the president by law to sign what are called findings, which are the authorizing documents. And it's not a matter of the CIA or any other one agency going off and doing its own thing, not by a long shot. And it's kind of ironic when we talk about the drones today, because we have reportedly the CIA doing things with that technology in some areas, and then the military using the same technology in other areas. And it's particularly strange when you get to South Asia, where if something takes place on one side of the Durand Line in Afghanistan, it's the military doing it, and if it takes place on the other side of that border in Pakistan, it's reportedly the CIA that's doing it. I see no reason why the principles and the restraints and the legal framework shouldn't be the same all around, regardless of which particular department of or agency the president chooses to use as his executive agent for carrying out a particular program. Now, historically, the CIA has gotten involved with a lot of these things because it happens to be the organization that has an overseas clandestine capability, which is there primarily to collect intelligence, to collect information that cannot be used or cannot be collected in any other way. And that gives you a tool, a capability that you may not find in any other department, even in the military, which, of course, has the physical capability to do a lot of things, but doesn't have the clandestine nature in most of its operations. But your basic point, I couldn't agree more. We shouldn't confuse the policy decisions and the issues those raise with institutional questions in terms of who's carrying something out.
So what was your reaction then, Paul Pillar, to what Rand Paul was saying, because it elicited a very angry response from John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who dressed down their junior colleague on the Senate floor.
Well, I'll leave it to more senior senators to express their own opinions about what the more junior ones should or should not be doing. I personally am sympathetic to what Rand Paul was doing insofar as he was trying to highlight the importance of the issue of legal transparency and consistency, and seeing to it that we in the public, even though we ought not to expect to have access to the ins and outs of classified information in individual cases, we can't expect that. We ought to expect to have access, and our members in Congress to have access, to the rules and the legal framework that underlie something as significant as the killing overseas through aerial means that we've come to know as the drone program. And so far, that transparency has only been grudgingly and in a limited way been granted by the administration. We've had a couple of these legal memos that reportedly members of the Intelligence Committee have been permitted to see, although without staff, and they can't take notes, and it's a really difficult framework for them to exercise oversight. But I think it would be quite proper, and this is the direction that Rand Paul was arguing for, to have a more transparent framework and one that can be readily debated openly.
Well, of course, how this so-called kill list is generated is a big question, and the rigor with which that's done, and the methodology, too. I mean, we don't know whether they're using computer analytics and all of these kind of things to put people on these lists. And, I mean, as a former intelligence officer, how do you feel about the nexus here between secrecy and the public's right to know?
Well, I agree with you, and I was speaking of legal framework, but it's more than just legal framework. It is a matter of criteria and process and rules that go beyond the strictly legal issues. The distinction to make here is, you know, we as a public cannot expect to find out everything about individual cases, about why Ahmed X someplace in Yemen has become a target, because that almost certainly will involve classified sources of and methods and properly classified ones.
Well, and also if you revealed it, he would no longer be a target. He'd go into hiding.
Exactly. That's the limitation. But what you're talking about, you know, the criteria that can be phrased in a more general way as to why someone gets on a list, I see no reason why that should not be more a matter of public scrutiny and discussion than it has been. Because after all, this gets to the heart of what we as citizens and our representatives in Congress ought to be doing in the way of weighing often conflicting principles and criteria and values, in this case, ones involving our security as well as due process and other important things to us. They don't always lean in the same direction. That's why we elect politicians, especially members of Congress who exercise oversight over the executive branch's activities in these areas, to make those sorts of weighing-type decisions. But they simply have not been able to do that because of the lack of transparency with most of what we're talking about.
Well, Paul Pillar, just in the last few minutes, I'd like to turn to the other roiling issue, if you will, and we talked about it earlier with Peter Bergen, which has come up with the arrest in Jordan and the forthcoming trial in New York of the bin Laden's son-in-law. And it raises, again, the question of this so-called, well, this war within the so-called war on terror, in as much as the president wants to close Guantanamo and others like Senator Lindsey Graham want to keep it open, and they're vowing to make sure this guy gets tried in Guantanamo. And it raises the question again of the so-called torture issue, which was in many ways revisited by the movie Zero Dark Thirty. A lot of people, I spoke to Glenn Carr, a former CIA officer who was involved with interrogations, and he was upset with the film, as was the Senate Intelligence Committee. And at the same time, you've got people like the CIA officer Rodriguez essentially, saying that this is how we got all these bad guys, including bin Laden, was through torture. So it seems like there's confusion within the intelligence community itself about whether torture works or doesn't work, or whether it's legal or appropriate. So where do we stand?
Well, first of all, I would express my pleasure with the fact that this suspect who was rounded up in Jordan is going into a proper Article III civilian criminal court in New York. And I have little patience for those like Senator Graham who try to make an ideological point that, well, this is a war, so we ought to do everything in a military tribunal. I totally sympathize with the administration on this one in not adding one more prisoner to Guantanamo when we're trying to reduce the population there. You know, on the torture issue, this, again, is one that goes far beyond any one agency or the intelligence community or the Justice Department or any other one component. This is an issue for all of us as Americans to consider in a way that takes account of how our own, referring again to the broader public, view of this has changed over time. And the long and the short of it is, in the immediate years after 9/11, there was a much greater tolerance for this sort of thing, for what's now known euphemistically as enhanced interrogation techniques. There was a public mood in favor of taking the gloves off and getting the bad guys and not restricting ourselves. And then it's only subsequent to that, over the more recent years, that people have understandably started to have qualms about this. And I think we all ought to recognize how the public and congressional mood has changed on this. And I think one of the frustrations you're seeing a little evidence of when you get statements from retired officers who might have been involved in this program is the frustration that comes with seeing the standards and the criteria shift under their feet as the public mood changes, and to be asked or expected to do one set of things at one time, and then after the public mood changes over the next few years, to be seen as the target of recrimination and the focus of demands for accountability. So rather than confusion, I think it's more that kind of frustration that you're seeing some evidence of.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Paul Piller.
It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Piller, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously, he served as the Chief of the Analytic Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East and Persian Gulf and South Asia. He also headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence Counterterrorism Center, which from 1997 to 1999, he was the Deputy Chief of the Center. Paul Piller is currently a professor of security studies at Georgetown University and is a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He, along with a group of senior military officers, recently signed a full-page letter to President Obama in the Washington Post, urging the president, Mr. President, say no to a war of choice with Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how both the left and the right share anti-government delusions.
The robot.